You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. My name is Joseph Toscano. The program is podcast. Young Darryl will be podcasting this program, won't you, Darryl?
I certainly will, Joe.
And yeah. You know why you podcast it?
Because I'm good at it.
Exactly, and and I don't know how to do it. That's the way it works, Darryl.
I know what all the knobs and buttons do.
You realise in life there are show ponies and draft horses. Uh-huh. Show ponies get the glory.
Yep.
Draft horses do the work.
Yep.
And unfortunately, at the minute, you're the draft horse, I'm the show pony.
Oh, I know. My name gets mentioned nowhere, I know.
Yeah, but don't you do a program at 3CR, don't you? Isn't your name mentioned there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about
you
that.
You forgot the program? What do you do, Darryl? What program do you do?
That's Breadline, where we tell all the unemployed people and people who are on disability what their rights are, because no one else does, not even the government tells them what their rights are.
Well, the great thing is unemployment levels are going up and you're going to have a few more followers.
Oh, well, more business for us, isn't it?
That's right. Now, unfortunately, the Reverend Robert Stringer, our guest, is a bit shocked about the way we have talking. Isn't that right, Robert?
No, I'm unshockable. I'm a clergyman.
You're a clergyman. what denomination?
Well, originally started off as a Methodist. In
a New Methodist, Zealand. Yeah, yeah.
And then when I came to Australia 40 years ago, I became a Uniting Church.
Yeah. You realise the Methodists were very important in the development of radical activities.
Yeah, they had what we called the social gospel.
That's right.
At least the radical side of it. There were the fundamentalist side, but the radical side is known for the social gospel.
Because I've done a series of presentations on the convicts who came across and how influential the Methodists were in that movement, because they were trusted, they were honest, you know? Unbelievable. And they also ate porridge, I understand.
I don't know where the porridge comes in.
They're Scottish, aren't they?
The Scottish ones, but a lot of them are English.
Are they? Right. Now, do you want to pull that microphone a bit closer to you? That's right. Yeah, excellent. Good. Well, you could actually move closer to the microphone. No, that's fine now. Yeah. Darryl will come around. He'll sort it out for you. Because we want people to hear.
We want to break it.
Everything's broken once here at 3CR. That's the way it works. Things get broken. Now, Robert, what year were you born, Robert?
1945.
40? Excuse me?
1945.
Are you an octogenarian yet?
Yes, I'm an octogenarian.
How does it feel?
Old.
Old. Do you need assistance to get out of bed in the morning?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
I reckon when I put another 20 years on it.
When you're 100. Well, where were you born?
I was born in a place called Kaikoura, which is a fishing village between Wellington and Christchurch on the east coast of the South Island.
And can you tell us something about your parents?
My father worked on the railways. So he did all sorts of jobs. And my mother was a school teacher.
Mm. Any siblings?
I have one sister and two brothers.
And they still with us?
Yes.
God, I'd love to have your family's genes.
They're all in New Zealand.
They're all in New Zealand.
Except my mother's long since gone.
Gone. Right. What? Yep. Your dad's still alive?
No.
No.
My dad was 45 when I was born.
45.
Yeah.
So you're just a glint in their eye. Yeah, a late addition, as they say, to the family.
Late addition, because it was a third marriage.
Third marriage.
My first wife died of TV.
Right.
Second wife ended in divorce, and then mum was the third
marriage. And so your siblings are mum's side or previous marriages?
No, siblings are all from her mum's side, but there is one sibling from my father's side who we only knew about 10 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
What, through that DNA analysis everybody does?
Not quite, but, you know, when you do you know, looking back into your past history try and put it all together. And one of the members of the family did it and suddenly said, oh, you've got a sister.
You've got a stepsister. Yeah. Amazing. So where did your parents come from?
Well, they're both from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. They're second generation New Zealanders. But my father sort of came from Scotland and my mother from the UK.
So what, they would have immigrated their families?
They would have immigrated in the mid-1800s.
Mid-1800s, just after the Treaty of Waitangi. Tangi, isn't it?
That was 1840.
Was it?
That'd be a bit later than that.
Yeah.
1860s.
Maybe. 1860s, right.
Yeah.
All right, and so what does a young lad do in New Zealand?
What did a young lad do in New Zealand?
Yeah, in those days, in the early 50s. Obviously, you went to school, hopefully.
Yeah, I went to Timaru Boys High School.
I've been to Timaru. That's the end of the universe.
No, it's a little farm, you know, a little farming centre. I mean, there's 25,000 people.
Yeah, but it's the end of the, isn't it the end of the South Island?
It was at least a city.
It was the end of the South Island.
No, it's in the middle of the South Island.
You want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
When I first started broadcasting at 3CR, you know, the anarchist program, this was 1977, there was some anarchists, believe it or not, in Timaru.
Okay.
And we would tape the program and we would post it to them and then they would broadcast it.
What, didn't they trust you? We broadcast it here.
No, we broadcast it here.
Oh, okay.
We would tape it for them
right.
and send it to them, and then they would broadcast it in New Zealand. And that's why I remember Timaru.
Okay.
And they had this great idea on how to make money.
Yeah.
You realise that postage stamps, you know, collecting them is kind of out of fashion, but in those days. So they created this artificial country in the Pacific, and they made stamps for this artificial country which they'd created, and then they would sell stamps to stamp collectors around the world. How do you like that? All from Timaru.
I didn't know there was one from Timaru. I knew there was a guy like that here in Australia who had his own country somewhere up in the Pilbara. Yeah.
Well, they didn't have this. Theirs was, they were ahead of the line. They had a virtual country. It didn't exist. They just made it up. There was this island in the Pacific called this. They made up these beautiful stamps and they sold them to make money.
Well, why not?
Oh, I agree. So they could be collector's items these days. So what was school like?
Oh, it was good. All boys school.
Yeah.
You had to do sport.
Sport.
I didn't like rugby. It was too rough. So I did mainly cross country in the winter and athletics in the summer.
Cross country. It snows there.
No. Not in Timaru. Well, it snowed once in my lifetime.
Oh, right. So it was all right.
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay. And did you get to high school?
Yeah, I went to high school. And then from high school, I went to University of Canterbury for 3 years. And then I went to Theological College.
Now, hang on. That's unusual, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, from university to theological, usually you go from university to radical activity or build a career. You don't go to theological college.
No, I learned radicalism a bit later.
Right.
In my clergy career.
Yeah, but why did you go to, why did you want to become a minister?
Well, I don't know. There's something in my head when I was at high school that said, oh, you ought to, well, some guy came along to our church one day, you know, he was head of international missions, and he said, oh, we want some guys who are good at this and that and keeping things going. And and I thought, well, I don't feel any particular call to go overseas, but I reckon I've got those skills. If you want me to go, I'll go.
So your family were regular churchgoers, were they?
My mother was.
Your mother.
Father used to be, but then
he saw the light.
Got slack, I think.
Yeah, like the rest of us. So what was he, a Christmas Easter Catholic, was he? Methodist? No,
he wasn't even that.
Not even that.
Yeah. The only time he went to church was when the lodge had a church parade.
Right. So what did you study at university at Canterbury?
I studied science. So I started off doing engineering intermediate.
Right.
Which you had to do maths, pure maths, applied maths, physics and chemistry.
Mm.
And I only got 3 out of 4 units, so I couldn't go on with that. So I went back and did applied maths and did some stage 2 maths. And wasn't a very good student at that stage. So after 3 years, I didn't quite finish my degree. So I, but I then applied to become a, you know, to train for the Methodist ministry.
That's a big decision for a young man. What have you been, about 22, 23?
Yeah, I was only 21.
21?
I was the youngest clergy, you know, clergy trainee. Well, I was the youngest clergy for about 21 years.
21 years.
Yeah, before anybody was sort of older than me. Because well, after me, most of the students were all, you know, married men or occasionally women.
Yeah.
But in my day, we were all, most, nearly all of us were single when we started. There was about eight of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were allowed to get married. We had to get permission.
You had to get permission.
At the end of our second year in theological college.
Oh, a little bit better than a Roman Catholic priest, isn't it? They never get permission unless they're a widower.
Yeah.
Isn't that? I think that's what happens. If you're a widower, you can actually become
that's
a
right.
priest. Yeah.
Well, if you're married, you're even allowed to.
What,
you
as a Catholic?
You don't have to be a widower. Yeah, you don't have to even be a widower. If you come through the Anglican tradition.
Right.
And you...
Yeah, yeah, but I'm talking about Roman Catholic.
Yeah, but if you come through from the Anglican tradition into the Catholic Church and you're married and you're ordained, you don't have to give up your wife.
So if you become an apostate, you go from Church of England to Roman Catholic, you can...
Not me.
No, but I mean...
Yeah, you could.
You can, and
yeah,
people do that.
Yeah.
And they've got a wife
not
and kids.
Not many. Yeah. Some do.
Wow. That's one way to get... to. Poach people, isn't it?
Well, that's one way to get a married priest.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, poach them across. So what was college like, theological college?
It was the best education I ever had. You
Why?
Know? Well, I mean, if you're interested in spiritual things, you had 3 years to sort of delve in and, you know, find out a little bit, you know, what this book we veneer, you know, the Bible, and you learn quite a bit about it, and that's rather interesting, and do all sorts of other interesting things like, you know, how to preach and church history and all that sort of thing. So I found it fascinating.
Well, why do we talk about dour Methodists? You know, it's kind of a, like, it goes together in the English language. Obviously, it's a put down.
I've never heard anybody talk about dour Methodists. We were too active for that.
No.
We had a social gospel. We had a social gospel.
Yeah, but no gambling, no whoring. It just goes on. You know, no drinking.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you couldn't be a rebel.
No, I understand that, but I mean, it's counter to popular.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I mean, the Dower Methodist minister.
Yeah, teetotal and anti-gambling. I don't know. I mean, you saved a lot of money.
Well, look, I've got nothing against it. All right, I'm just saying that's. I mean, I just remember when I was a young bloke, you know, I was the Dower Methodist, you know.
Yeah, well, okay, I can.
I mean, the good thing about Catholics is they just get drunk and gamble, so it's not a problem there. Well, not all of them, but some
Methodists. We can express ourselves in other ways.
Do you? Yeah, through social justice.
Yeah, you could thumb your nose at the toffees.
So when you talk about social justice, was there lectures or was it just a feeling within the college?
Well, the Methodist Church has always had a strong social justice thing because it was brought, it came into being in industrial England, and it was really the Anglican side of the church. Well, the Anglicans failed to move into the industrial towns in Britain.
Yeah.
So few Anglican clergy decided that they would have a ministry to people who worked in all the factories, and they weren't very well accepted, so they sort of left the Anglican church, that was John and Charles Wesley, and started their own church.
Isn't it true that the Anglicans at that particular time were basically seen by the new industrial workers and a lot of the farm labourers as just the ministers for the rich because they paid their...
They stayed with their, you know, they didn't move into the towns. They stayed with, you know, what do they call them?
The estates.
Yeah, the estates where they were sponsored by the rich, as you say. And, and it was that failure that led to the Methodists coming into being.
You think that's the basis of that social justice element to it?
Yeah, so we were concerned about working conditions, about pay rates and all that sort of thing. Right from the beginning.
Right.
And then, you got caught up in all sorts of other social justice issues along the way.
Right. So what year did you graduate from the college?
Oh, well, I was ordained in 1971.
Right. So what?
So I left and I started ministry in 68.
68.
In a dairy farming in the Waikato, you know, high-density dairy farming area.
So what's the difference between being a minister and being ordained? Because there was a three-year gap there, which I don't understand.
Well, you, as part of your training, you did the theoretical training, you know, educational,
right.
And then you had to do 2 years. If you had a degree already, you only had to do 2 years, and then you ordained over those.
So it was your apprenticeship, basically.
Yeah, it was apprenticeship.
In real life.
Yeah, it was an apprenticeship type model, and if you didn't have a degree, which I didn't at that stage, I had to do 3 years.
Right.
And then at the end of 3 years, they would say, oh, you're okay or you're out.
Were you still celibate then, or have you met your wife by then?
Got married to my first wife when we were second year in college. Yeah. We were allowed, we had to get permission.
Yeah,
we
got permission.
At the end of our second year, we started our third year. Right.
So what was life like during this apprenticeship period in this dairy community?
Well, it was certainly the most conservative community I've ever been in. Right. You know, everybody was Roman Catholic, Protestant, Maori, communist or whatever. And, you know, it was so oppressive. I can remember, because I'd been out to the Solomons, between when I finished college and took up my first appointment, I spent 3 months out in the Solomon Islands. So I came back and I was telling the Women's Fellowship group about work in the Solomon Islands, and one woman gets up, why did you bother to go out there and help those black people for? That's the sort of... And people were... I mean, I've even been in the position at that time, and this is what radicalised me, where my own parishioners were throwing rocks at me.
Your parishioners were throwing rocks at you?
The parishioners, these dairy farming families, had batches at a local, you know, seaside resort. And there was a South African life-saving team. So we were part of a protest against the South African lifesavers.
Right.
You know, apartheid.
Yep, 71,
and
yep.
There were a group of youths who were throwing rocks.
Right.
And I found out later that some of them were in my Bible class.
In your Bible class.
So there we are.
You didn't succeed there, did you?
So that's where I was starting to get radical.
So then why did you get involved in the anti-apartheid struggle?
Well, that was the big issue.
Yeah, but why? I mean, you could have stayed and shut your mouth and...
I was really thumbing my nose at the local parishioners. Saying, I'm not like you. You know, I reckon there's a lot of things that are not very just.
So you were biting the hand that was feeding you, local parishioners?
More or less.
Yeah, right. No wonder they threw rocks. All right, let's get to the next parish. What happens after that?
Well, after that, 3 years in that, when I went overseas to the Solomon Islands for 6 years.
6 years?
Yeah.
During the 70s?
Yep, 70s.
What parts of the Solomon Islands?
Well, I spent 3 years on the island of Choiseul in a rural village called Sasamonga.
Right.
Now, Choiseul is the next island next to Bougainville in the Solomon Islands side of the border.
Right.
Yeah, very isolated. The only way to get there was by ship. There were no roads on the island. And so I had a canoe, and the island was probably 150 kilometres long. I had a parish of about 6,000.
Right.
And I was 26 years old.
Right.
So here's me, a young upstart, 26 years old.
You're going to change the world.
And I was superintendent of a parish of 6,000.
1,000, right.
Now, that's crazy.
Well, did they teach you to relax after a while?
Well, it was the most rewarding experience I had because it taught me about culture.
Right.
It taught me I had a culture. And I was living with people who had a very different culture, different family values, different structures, different leadership qualities, all that sort of stuff. And then I realised the Bible has a whole series of cultures. It's not just one culture.
Right.
Over a whole series of years. And, yeah, to understand the culture, to be able to understand the context, right, even of the Bible. And so much people who have no understanding of culture really don't understand, you know, they're projecting their own marriage values or, you know, onto the stories. Mm. But if you understand culture, you say, well, wait a minute, what's happening here?
Mm.
You know, what were the Romans doing? What were the Christians, you know, what were their values? What was happening in the Old Testament?
Yeah.
You know, when Moses was pushing the Egyptians around and what happened when they were in Babylon, you know, they were in exile.
Yeah.
You know, what was it like to be in exile? And they had, you know, lost their king, they lost their temple, they had lost their country.
Yeah.
And the Babylonians would say, now, where's your God now?
Yeah.
And they came to the insight, God is with us in our suffering. That's where you get this Old Testament, you know, links with Jesus, that God was with the people of Israel in Babylon in their suffering.
You realise there's a derogatory term for you.
What's that?
You went native. I mean, you actually didn't impose your viewpoints. You immersed in the culture. So... You know, they used to say, you know, soldier goes to India and he's gone native, he's married a local woman. You know, that's how as a derogatory term. You went native, mate.
Well, I suppose it's a bit like that. But
yeah. No, it's not derogatory. It's unusual.
Yeah.
That's why they'd say, you know, he's gone native. You know, 95% would, you know.
Anyway, it was fantastic. And then I moved to Honiara.
Right.
And that was the centre of power and you got involved in politics and all that sort of stuff.
So what type of politics did you get involved in?
We worked with the Seventh-day Adventists, the Anglicans, the South Sea Evangelical Church, and the Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
So there were five main churches. And what were the issues?
This would be the late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, I was just trying to...
Was Solomon Islands independent by then?
No, this is just prior to independence.
Right.
I left the year they became independent.
Independence, right.
So we were very much... I mean, the church was already independent.
Right.
So my role was, I wasn't a missionary. I was a pastor working in their church, helping them to become independent, helping the Solomon Islanders. So when I left, the Solomon Islanders could take over.
Right, right.
And so I had to work in dismantling the old mission structures.
Right.
So to give you an example, when I went to Sasamonga, there was an elderly mission sister who was there who had taken over. She was the superintendent and she ran an office of the Commonwealth Bank. She had everybody's bank account on the island, wouldn't leave their bank account and bank books there. She controlled all the finances and she controlled everything. But so she went on leave and so... When she went on leave, I took down the radio and shifted it to my house and shifted everything so that when she came back, I had been able to break the structures where she controlled communications and everything else so that I could, and then whoever followed me, who was a Solomon Islander, could take over and not be controlled by this European woman who'd been there for 40 years when I lived there.
So what happened after you left the Solomon Islands? You were married then? Was your wife, your first wife with you?
Yeah. I was married when I went to the Solomon Islands.
Yeah, and she was quite happy with the situation?
No. It was the isolation of the first 3 years, really led to a marriage breakup finally,
right.
I think.
Right, yes.
That, plus we didn't have the skills as young people. We didn't have the skills to understand the pressures that we were under. And to be able to talk about them, you know, we had tensions.
Right.
And we perhaps got cross or cranky with each other, but we really didn't have the skills to say, hey, this is what's going on for us.
So,
like I would go off for a week at a time on patrol, as they would call it in PNG. And that would leave her at home a bit isolated.
Yeah.
And she found that very hard.
It would be very hard.
Yeah. We had two young children.
It would be very hard. Right. Yeah. So after Solomon Islands, where were you posted, as they say?
After the Solomon Islands, I came back to New Zealand and I said, I don't want to go back into a congregation. Right. I want to use the skills that I've acquired in the overseas in this cross-cultural area. So there was a job came up in Perth, which was the Synod Consultant for Social Justice, Cross-Cultural Mission, the Development of the Aboriginal Church and the Development of Migrant Congregations. And I did that for 9 years. That was the best job I ever had.
Why?
Just the sheer variety.
Right.
I mean, I got arrested, I got put in jail.
Excuse me. Reverend, look, I hate, most people don't think reverends get arrested unless they were fighting apartheid in, you know, in South Africa. So what did you do?
It was the era of Sir Charles Court.
That's right, Sir Charles
Sir
Court.
Sir Charles Court.
Thank
Sir
you.
Sir Charles Court was aiming to screw the Aboriginal communities.
Yeah.
And cut them out of any mining royalties
deals, yeah,
or anything like that. So I'd be monitoring this and also keeping the National Church involved in that. And so it came to a confrontation where a convoy of 60 oil drilling rig trucks left a place called Eneabba, north of Perth, and went 2,000 kilometres up to a place called Nukumba Station to drill for oil on this Aboriginal sacred site. So a few of us clergy and a lot of Aboriginal people were protesting against that. And so we went up with five other clergy from the eastern states, and we sat with the Aboriginal people to block this convoy, and we got arrested and put in jail.
In jail.
Only for a day.
Right.
The rest of my friends, who were all from the eastern states, they paid the fine. I think it was obstructing traffic.
Yeah, yeah.
It was $3.50 or something like that.
And you refused.
And I refused because they also slapped on a resisting arrest. Now, I didn't resist arrest. I mean, I had my hands clasped. No. They'd videoed all this. And passive resistance does not constitute resisting
arrest. I'm afraid, Robert, under the law, if they tell you to stand up and you don't stand up and walk away with them, that is resisting arrest.
Yes.
You understand that?
That's right. They had to extract me because
yeah,
the Aboriginal people were holding me.
Yeah, that's right. You had to be extracted. That is resisting,
yes,
all right? That is
extracted.
Resisting. And what happened after that?
I spent about 10 days in court.
In court?
Yeah.
In and out of jail, going to court and back?
No, we weren't in jail. We just had to turn up. The first ones were obstructing traffic.
Right.
Well, I pleaded not guilty to that, so I had to go to trial.
Right.
And then the other ones, resisting arrest. So it took about 10 days to process those charges. And I had to go up to Fitzroy Crossing. And
right.
It was a very interesting and educative experience to be on the other side of the law.
Right.
And I got off. The government had never gazetted the road properly.
Right.
So what was a private road on the station, which they were supposedly gazetted as a public road so that they could arrest you.
Wasn't.
They didn't do it properly, and so we got off on that.
Bloody city lawyers. They're all the same. They're always looking for loopholes.
A friend of mine was senior lecturer in law at university, and he went up with me, and we got off along with about 28 Aboriginal people.
Right. Look, it's just past 4:30. We were having a chat with Robert Stringer, the chaplain for the West Papuan office in Melbourne. Daryl's pushing all the buttons to ensure people can hear us.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
All right. After you left West Australia, what happened next?
Well, after that, because when I was working for the Synod, I understood culture, but I knew nothing about Aboriginal people. So I went to university and did Aboriginal anthropology.
Right.
And then ordinary anthropology. And then I did politics at UWA.
And who paid for all that? The church? No?
The church paid for all of that.
Good.
So I studied those things.
Yeah.
And when I finished this job, I thought, I've got to finish this degree, because I hadn't finished that previous one, which was in science, so I thought I'd finish this one. So I went back to, I switched across to Murdoch University and finished it. And so I got a degree in both politics and sociology right. from Murdoch University.
And what did that lead to?
Well, as soon as I finished that, then I became the National Director for Social Justice in Sydney for the Uniting Church.
Hang on. Now, I'm a bit confused here. We started off as a Methodist. You are now the director, the National Director for Social Justice for Uniting Church. How did that come about?
Well, I started off as a Methodist, but when I came to Australia, I worked for the Uniting Church.
Oh.
So I haven't worked for the Methodist, because the Methodists were already part of the Uniting Church.
The church, right. Okay. And then, so when was the great upheaval when the churches joined together as the Uniting Church?
Well, it was just prior to when I came. It was in 77, and I came in 79.
Right. Okay. So,
yeah.
So what does the National Director for Social Justice do?
The job was to guide the church and do whatever policy work that needed to be done.
So you're a professional rabble-rouser?
No. I was a bureaucrat.
You're a bureaucrat. You weren't a professional rebel-rouser. you were actually organising the rebel to rouse.
Absolutely.
All right, okay. You were one step away.
Yeah.
Very good, Robert. So very good.
Elevated. So we were doing all sorts of issues, particularly in terms of unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think some of the other issues at that time.
Well, there's always the land rights movement.
There was land rights were a big thing.
Yeah.
Mining, whole thing of mining, came up against Hugh Morgan and all those
nice people. Yeah.
Nice people. Yeah. So we.
How about Mr. Hancock, the old Mr. Hancock? Was that before your time?
Well, Hancock had just passed on by then.
Right.
The big people were Hugh Morgan worked for, I think it was CRA.
Right.
Challenging those mining companies. They even flew me up to Papua New Guinea and to look at the mine.
Was the Sepik River mine or the gold mine there? Or?
No, it wasn't. It was on the southern side.
Southern side, right. Don't worry, it's on the southern side, yeah.
We were protesting against this mine because what they were doing was they were mining copper and then throwing everything down the river.
Yep.
And it was clogging the river and covering the forest.
Destroying things. Yeah.
So we were protesting, they flew us up to have a look at it.
Yeah. Who's they? The church?
The
miners. The actual company?
Yeah, the company, BP.
BP, they were unhappy with what was happening.
Yeah, they flew us up to show us all their sort of social work that they were doing in villages.
Oh, right.
But it still didn't cover
that.
And we were able to see I've still got the photographs of this.
Yeah.
The shingle coming down and just spreading out over the jungle. Huge trees, and this shingle was just...
Right.
Just smothering the bush.
And they had the audacity to bring you there to show they were doing the right thing. They must have thought you were crazy.
They were the ones that were crazy.
Well, exactly. All right.
We were going to change.
So how long did you last as the national director for?
6 years.
And then after that?
After that, my wife had a good job in Sydney.
Now, is this the first or the second? The
second wife.
Right.
And so we wanted to stay in Sydney. And while we were in Sydney, we lived where the Aboriginal people lived, in Redfern.
Right. Redfern,
We lived on the block.
On the block.
On the block.
Not many people can say that.
Next to a couple of Catholic sisters who were also living there. So my wife had a job, and she had been on the committee of a local neighbourhood centre that were running programs for the Aboriginal families.
So what's your wife's name?
Mary.
Mary, right.
They were running programs for the Aboriginal families on the block.
Right.
And this was the Settlement Neighbourhood Centre, which had a long history way back to the 1880s. Arnold Toynbee and a few clergy who were back in the 1880s decided if you wanted to do social justice, you had to go and live with the people in the community. And they had brought that model to Australia. So that, and it was the wives of the lecturers at Sydney University that started it. So they bought one of the terraced houses in Chippendale, which was working class, and they gutted it and made it into a community hall and ran programs, right. Children's programs, youth programs, family programs for the working class people in that area using the settlement model. Was that you? If you wanted to do these things, you had to get your hands dirty and to actually work.
Excuse me, you had to get your hands dirty. You just couldn't give orders.
No, you didn't give orders.
So when you're on the block, you got your hands dirty.
Yeah, on the block, you know, you visited the people and you helped. Well, when we were there, you were helping to find bags that had been snatched and helping, you know, a lot of alcoholism, helping the. The grandmas were the mainstay of the families there, helping them, you know, give them support.
Yeah,
I mean it was a great job,
right?
But it was one of the hardest jobs to do, given the dysfunctional nature of the families that were living there. The men had all disappeared, and the wives, you know, the younger generation were alcoholic and that sort of thing. So it was the grandmas. Who really kept the show on the road.
So it was the elders that kept it all together.
And we ran the programs that supported.
So that type of intervention, that type of work does have a personal cost. So how long did you last there for?
3 years. I did it for 3 years. Then I decided, no, that was enough. Mm. And we then moved to Melbourne. Because we were looking at retirement and we wanted to move to the community before we retired, so that we worked there. And
so you've now become our problem.
That's right.
You and Mary have become our problem.
Absolutely.
So what does an elderly Uniting Church minister who's been involved in social justice campaigns all his life turns up at Melbourne? Were you welcomed with open arms?
Yeah, I got a job with the local church in Rosanna.
Mm-hmm. As a chaplain?
As a minister, pastor.
Yeah,
they accepted me. I mean, when I...
This wasn't like the dairy crew down at Tumaru, was it?
No.
Rosanna?
The issues in the congregation were accepting gay and lesbian people as members.
Right.
And accepting gay and lesbian couples.
Right.
You know, as couples. And accepting gay and lesbian clergy. They were the big issues.
Right.
So when I was negotiating with them, I said to them, look, I'm supportive of gay and lesbian people and gay and lesbian couples.
Hmm.
And as I said, they didn't blink.
Right.
I mean, if they'd blinked. So they knew, you know, those were the sort of big social justice issues.
And what year was this? When you came down to Melbourne?
2006.
2006, right, yeah. Yeah, they would have been, you're quite right, yeah.
Yeah, so they were the big issues, and they didn't blink.
Right.
So that, and I said, look, I'm not going to push this down your throat, but you've got to know that's where I start from.
Right.
And so we had a good ministry there, and that's when I got involved with the West Papuans. And
Hang on. I'm a bit confused here. I'm a bit slow, Robert. Right. You come to Rosanna, which to me isn't a great focus or meeting point for West Papuans, then you get involved with West Papuans. How did that happen?
Well, we went to a meeting of Pax Christi,
right,
which is the Catholic Social Justice Group, because we wanted to make contact. This is when we first arrived in about 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And Louise
Byrne, yep.
Yeah, she turned up with a number of West Papuans and said, we want places, you know, homes for them to live while they study.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rickard Rumbiak was one of those. And so Rickard lived with us for 5 years. That was my introduction to West Papua.
So Rickard, while he was going to the ministry, was he?
He was just learning English for the first couple of years.
At that stage, right, yeah.
And then he was trying to do some local courses before he decided to become a pastor.
Right.
So he lived with us for 5 years.
Right. Well, and obviously all the kids had moved out by then, hadn't they?
Yeah, all our kids had long gone.
Yeah.
So we had Rickard living with us and that introduced us.
There may be people listening to the program, most likely 97%, wouldn't know who Ricardo is and why I mention him. I know he's living with you, he's West Papuan.
Well, that introduced us to his uncle, Jacob Rumbiak, who's the Foreign Minister of the Federal Republic of West Papua.
Oh.
So, and my interest in politics ended up getting to know what the politics were and supporting Jacob wherever I could.
Right.
And then we decided Rickard wanted to go back to West Papua after he got permanent citizenship and a passport.
Right.
So in 2015...
So all these people you were basically interacting with from West Papua were refugees.
Yeah, they were refugees. Came in 2006.
Yeah, they came across in the boat. In the canoe. They ended up in northwest...
Yeah, so I've been a sort of like a chaplain to them.
Right. So, yeah, because was it 43 or 41? I've forgotten.
They were 42.
Yep. They turned up in northwest coast and there was nobody there to welcome them.
That's right.
And then this was during the Howard
era. And they went off to Christmas Island for a while and then they were brought to Melbourne.
Right.
And
some of them went to Ballarat to study. Yep,
that's right. Well, yep. Rickard was one of the... Rickard was already here as a student, but he sort of merged and became a refugee once he had his study options and finished.
Right.
So he became a refugee. Yep.
So I understand... Last time we spoke to you was about 9 years ago, and obviously we didn't have podcasts then, so whatever we said, nobody remembers. But I understand that you went to West Papua.
Yeah.
What, as a tourist, as a minister, as what?
Well, I went with Rickard because he was going back to see his family.
Right.
And and also at that stage he was negotiating... to get married to Lalise.
Right.
The marriage had sort of been arranged within the church, sort of circles.
Right.
And so we went to Wamana, that's where they first met, and then we went to his village way up on the north coast near Biak. Right. Biak's the island there, but then we came back to Jairapura and back to Wamana so that he could meet Lalise.
Right.
Who was then his fiancée, and we spent a week there, and then we were to go back to Jairapura and back to the village.
Right.
And we got to Jairapura, and he was so lovesick at that stage, and I was sort of like a father to him.
Right.
I said, we're going back.
Yeah, go back. Right.
So we went back to the village and spent another 2 weeks
there,
so that they had a much better time together to get to know each other.
So how long were you in West Papua?
We were there for 6 weeks.
Can you tell us your memories about that visit, what you saw, what you felt?
Well, you're very aware of the military.
Why?
When we went to his village, we were told there's a couple of people who are liaisons with the military who were monitoring what we were doing.
Right.
And then we went from the... So we went were there over Christmas. I mean, we weren't doing anything unusual. Mm. And then we went up to Wamana. And in Wamana, we saw the more naked power, you know, these big black people movers that the police had.
Yep.
And batons and...
Right.
And saw the more naked power being used against the West Papuans.
Right.
And all that machinery stuff that they had for keeping the peace.
So you could see that they were an occupying force. They weren't welcome.
Very aware.
Right.
And then we went back to Jairapura and we were made aware that people were watching us.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But you returned.
Yep.
Yeah. So, what happened when you returned? This is what, 2006, is it?
Or yeah. Well, it was 2015-16.
2015 and 16 when
you went 2015, we went there in December and came back at the end of January in 16.
Yeah. Well, that was 6 weeks. That was a pivotal moment for the West Papuan community in Melbourne.
Yeah. So, it was a pivotal moment on West Papua. And I've certainly been involved with the West Papuan community ever since and seen for my own eyes, just how bad it can be.
Right. Yeah. So it's no longer an academic exercise. It's personal. No,
it's personal, yeah.
Right. Because people you know, people you've contacted, people you've spoken to, their bodies turn up, in a street somewhere.
Well, we know about those sort of things, yeah.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. I mean, these are people that, these are the type of things you don't expect. And just before we started chatting, you're telling me about the What's just happened the last few days that you found incredulous?
Yeah, we were looking on today with Louise and others. We have a Zoom meeting every week to just monitor what's going on in West Papua. So we were shown a video which showed the military had gone around and collected all these beautiful headdresses with these bird of paradise feathers and everything else like that. They must have about had 50 or 60 or more of them, and they were just sitting there throwing them onto the fire.
Right. Just like a Nazi book burning.
Yeah.
Exactly like the same.
They were just, they had these oil drums, which they had burning you know, fuel in them, and they were just throwing these headdresses in. It was shocking to see.
Shocking to see.
You know, that's cultural genocide.
Yeah. Well, it is cultural genocide. They want them to speak, was it Bahasa? Is it Bahasa?
Bahasa,
speak Bahasa in the schools.
Yeah.
They can't speak the traditional languages, inadequate health care, constant oppression. And then there's a little bit of resistance, you know, in the highlands, and there's mass slaughter and mass migration across to West Papua.
Exactly. It's happening, a lot of it surreptitiously.
Yeah. But the good thing is we support it, the Australian government. We train their troops, which at Camp Kununga in North Queensland.
We can't get the government. The government's too wedded to the Lombok Treaty, and it's the implications of that for
could
its
you,
relationship.
Could you explain to us what the Lombok Treaty is?
The Lombok Treaty, I can't remember quite the date of it, was when Indonesia and Australia came to an agreement and did a treaty to say that they that Australia wouldn't interfere in the internal affairs.
That's right.
Of Indonesia.
That's right. The Sahara,
which include West Papua.
Yeah, it was quite interesting that when they've just signed this undertaking with Papua New Guinea, that the undertaking excludes Australian troops actually being deployed on the border between Papua New Guinea and West Papua, if something occurs. It's just extraordinary, isn't it? When is a treaty not a treaty? And the Papua New Guinea said, well, we don't really think it's a treaty when it involves the Chinese.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Australia is, and this is what people don't realise, we have been training troops from Indonesia for decades, usually at Kununga and just outside Brisbane. We have been supplying them with arms.
Exactly.
We have trained them in counterinsurgency. We've sent out so-called experts to go to West Papua and other places where there's been a little bit of, you know, resistance to the Indonesian occupation. Because it's really, it's not an Indonesian occupation, it's the Javanese occupation, isn't it, really?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's the Javanese have basically taken over all those islands which make up Indonesia.
Yeah, it's the transmigration, which most of the people come from Java, not all of them, but because of the overpopulation in Java and that. They've been transmigrating to West Papua for years, and now there are more Indonesians in West Papua than there are Indigenous people.
Right.
And that's bad.
Right. Well, it's kind of a parallel to what happened to Australia with the colonisation process.
Exactly.
The parallels are just extraordinary. The parallels with Palestine, the parallels with West Papua.
Yep.
Because West Papua is one of the few nations that still hasn't been decolonised around the world.
Well, it's neo-colonial,
yeah,
because you've got the Indonesians acting in a colonial way.
Yeah, right. Okay. Now, you've been involved with the West Papuan office since its beginning. A lot of people ask me, you know, what's the point of having this office? What's the point of raising money to pay the rent for this office? Could you explain to us its pivotal role in the West Papuan independence movement?
Well, I always start off by referring to East Timor. And remember Ramos Horta, his role. He was the sort of foreign embassy that went around wherever he could to
sleeping on people's couches, I remember quite clearly.
Helping people, helping whoever he could contact to understand what was happening in East Timor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jacob Rumbiak is the equivalent of that for the West Papuans. Jacob has been exiled from Indonesia because of his political activities, very high profile, and Jacob has been made the foreign minister, because he's in exile, of the Federal Republic of West Papua, which is the indigenous people of West Papua have formed their own sort of counter-government, almost like a government in waiting, saying, look, we've got the skilled people, we've got the structure, we've got the people, and if and when it happens, we'll be able to take over in West Papua.
But what role does the office play in all this?
Well, the office is the office of the foreign minister.
Right.
But it's also the office for any activists who can join the cause and help promote awareness of what's happening in West Papua.
So it actually acts as a organising focus outside of West Papua.
Yep.
Right, yeah, because there's very few, I understand, offices around the world.
There's one in London.
And that's it, yeah.
And there's one, and there is a bit of organisation in the Netherlands.
Right.
Because the Netherlands was the colonial power in West Papua, so right. There is vestiges of there. But Benny Wender, who's the president of the Federal Republic, he's in London. And Jacob is here in Melbourne, and the rest are all internal.
Internal, yeah.
And many of them have been in prison in the past, and the present Indonesian government tolerates this. They used to clamp down on it and put them in prison, but they're tolerating it.
Tolerating.
Yep.
Yeah, so the West Papuan office isn't just simple, superfluous piece of fluff. It plays a pivotal role in that.
Absolutely.
In that West Pass,
and we network around the world.
Yeah,
what's happening?
Yeah, because I've been involved since the beginning, and it's. Yep. I mean, my role is very simple: is to raise money to pay the rent.
To pay the rent, and the rest of us is to.
Yeah.
To populate, to people it with volunteers.
Yeah, yeah.
And we fly the flag.
Now I understand that on Sunday the 16th of November. Which is only, 3 weeks away, we're having the final gathering for the year in the West Papuan office?
Yeah, well, three times a year we have what we call an open day.
Yep.
We encourage all our volunteers and anybody who can take an interest and who we sort of want to influence, and we always have a speaker and we have paraphernalia and pamphlets and badges and whatever to help promote the cause.
Excuse me, you've forgotten the most important thing, lunch.
Yeah, we
You have lunch.
Yeah, we have a lovely
1 o'clock,
lunch.
Starts at 1.
That's right, 1 o'clock.
I know it's been difficult for people because they've been torn when we have things between the Palestinian protests, which is on a Sunday, but obviously the Palestinian protests, I think, have decreased since this little bodgy ceasefire. So people... Yeah. If they've got the time, it's a great time to find out about the West Papuan independence struggle.
Absolutely.
Have a look at the office, meet the volunteers, and you can always join the rent collective, a miserable dollar a day, and you get three meals. Isn't that great for $365 bucks? I mean, you wouldn't get that in a restaurant these days,
That's right.
You're paying $7.50.
And there's a famous auctioneer.
Is there really?
He's got a great way of extracting money from
That's
people.
Right. Well, there is the very famous West Papuan office. Now, if you're sick and tired of buying plastic shit for the grandkids, which falls apart within 4 days, we encourage you to come along on the 16th of November. It's at 838 Collins Street in Docklands. The tram stops in front of it, I think. You just walk around the back. Don't knock on the door at the front. Walk around the back. Lunch starts at 1.
Yep.
West Papuan Rent Collective members get a free lunch. Everybody else needs to chuck in a few bucks to assist us. Then we've got our guest speakers from Holland. I think there are 2 guest speakers from Holland.
Yep, this time on the
16th. Then we have the auction. And everything that is at the auction is handmade. It's not mass-produced. And this year, we've actually got... David has made some fascinating bits and pieces for us, including what I call spoodles, are they? Spoondles or something?
Something like that.
They're porridge stirrers, that are traditional porridge stirrers from... not stirrers, but traditional porridge stirrers, initially made from Congo timber, believe it or not. So come along and bid for it. Every cent that is raised goes to pay the rent. Everybody's a volunteer. Nobody gets a cent. Well, thank you, Darryl. We'll let you wrap up for us.
Not a problem, Joe. You have been listening to Radical Australia with presenter Joe Toscano and special guest Reverend Robert Stringer here on 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 AM on your dial, online at 3cr.org.au, and this program has been podcasted. Stay tuned now for Brainwaves coming right up.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.